This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was dark and cold, and Bruce Stutz needed renewal badly. The former editor-in-chief of Natural History magazine grabbed an old Chevy and hit the American road on the blooming trail of spring. For a whole season, he chased it, the bursting with life surge and crest of the season of light's return, of rebirth, across the magnolia south and fresh cactus southwest, across plains and mountains, even into the Arctic spring, nose down in vernal pools, exulting in salamander hookups and the onslaught of frogs, in cranes dancing and rivers of spring caribou, and worrying, too, that spring is changing. Up next on Point, in the glory of the lilies, juice, joy, and a jangled, warming planet, we're on the road and chasing spring. Joining me now from sunny Miami is Bruce Stutz. He's a science writer for Discover magazine and contributing editor at On Earth magazine. He's also author of the delightful new book, Chasing Spring, An American Journey Through a Changing Season. Bruce Stutz, thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Wonderful to have you, and what a trip. There's listeners, you can find a map of Bruce Stutz's travels at our website, onpointradio.org, right across the country. And you got set off on the whole thing, not by the beauty of a new dandelion, but by some heart surgery that you had you down and out in a dark November and longing for the light.
It was not a time that was pleasant to go through, although the heart surgery was necessary and feel much better now. But it was a difficult winter to get through.
Tell us what it led you to do and why.
Well, I had this surgery to repair a heart valve that was faulty original equipment, as you might say.
Right. Congenital.
So once it was repaired and I was recovering, and anyone who's had open heart surgery, which is essentially what the surgery consisted of, knows how hard it is to recover from that. There's the time where you can barely walk and the time where you feel exhausted. And this time was happening over the winter. So the combined period of darkness, which winter sinks us into, and the combined period of depression from the heart surgery made me think that I wanted to revive myself. And like most people do during the winter, they say to themselves, well, come spring, I'll do this, or come spring, I'll fix the house, or come spring,
yeah, sure,
I'll do this. And my feeling was, come spring, I wanted to follow the spring.
Not just to taste spring, but to have it all, really, as spring unfolded, sort of heading from south to north across the continent.
Well, as a nature writer for a long time, you get to cover a lot of stories and you get to go out a lot, which is the nice part about it. But the one thing that I really realized that I hadn't done was to follow some natural event from its beginning to its end. And so I saw this as an opportunity to do that, as well as connect myself with the season's revival.
And we're going to hear exactly how you did that. We want to hear a lot of your reading in this hour as well, Bruce Stutz. It's really wonderful. You've got a portion here talking about what spring means to us as humans, means to us in culture. You're lying there preparing, I guess, for surgery. We'll hear about the gurney coming for you. But as you did, you're thinking about the spring of childhood when it's just spring and you're part of it. You're youthful and part of the new life oneself. But there, looking at it from your 50-something, darkening November hospital bed, I wish you'd read for us.
Well, what this came out of was seeing my kids before I went into surgery and realizing that the connection between a father and his children, between parents and children, is that you get out of them the energy that they have. And so what I realized was, we can't be children in just spring again, but being intimate with such energy is every bit as good as being a part of it. And so we're affected when spring comes, with its spawning, nesting, breeding, brooding, rising lignin, peeping peepers, its skunk cabbage and may apple, crocus and magnolia bloom, dandelion and daffodil. When spring comes on the wind, an osprey call from familiar hangs, when shorebirds flash across the marsh at dusk, when songbirds sweep into the forest to chirrup May, and butterflies flutter on solitary flights, when all flock determinedly north, fishes up by ancestral streams, salmon, shad, quicksilver schools of herring, and big-eyed hag-faced lamprey. We sow crops, play ball, leave our jackets on the playground at recess, free and in shirt sleeves, for then comes Hinamatsuri, Holi, Passover, Easter, Rowanfest. Then comes light, resurrection, renewal, joy of survival from heart surgery, joy of spring when, chorus Thomas Nash, blooms each thing, the pretty birds do sing, coo-coo, jug-jug, pooey, tuwita-woo. And when, effused Gerard Manley Hopkins, weeds and wheels shoot long and lovely and lush, and when D.H. Lawrence wondered, what fountain of fire am I among this leaping combustion? Then we want to be a part of it all. Better come quick, for I hear the gurney rattling down the hall.
Bruce Stutz reading from his new book, Chasing Spring, An American Journey Through a Changing Season. And so you hop into a 20-year-old Chevy Impala, not exactly a hybrid or bicycle, I must say, Mr. Nature Writer. and with your gas-guzzling glory, head out across the nation. Give us a sense of your trail.
Well, I look at it this way. I live in New York City, and so I take public transportation all the time, and so I could get my 3 months in a car.
You've got it coming. Yeah. Okay.
Right, exactly. The car came from a friend of mine. His mom had died. She was 90, and it was a – he said, well, you could borrow her car, and I said, what kind is it? He said, it's a 1984 Chevy Impala, which didn't raise my spirits at all when I heard that. But then I found out that it only had 28,000 miles on it.
Hey, all right, let's go.
Right, since she was the perfect old lady who just drove it to church on Sundays for 20 years. So I got the car, and it was one of these wonderfully huge cars, the kind with the that kind of leaned towards the back end and the front end a little higher. It was a great car to drive in, and we called it my friend and I called it Moby Dick because it was a huge white whale of a car, and so it was great. I packed it with all my gear, everything fit into the trunk, and I knew I could sleep on the seat if I had to. And I took off to follow the spring season.
And as you write, you imagined surfing a wave of green as it sweeps north, catching the first bloom, first birds, first thaw, first rains, first flood, first leaves, first fruits, plowed fields, desert floor to tundra bloom. And you actually did that. You ended up all the way in the Arctic. I loved your rules for the trip as sort of posted on the dashboard, more or less, here by Bruce Stutz. Always have enough gas. Let yourself be distracted. You're never lost, just exploring. For health, take one Eastwood a day, as in a siesta, and one Jack Daniels each night, and off you went.
I did. It was those rules were rules I guess I had accumulated over the course of my life, that these are the things that when you travel, you always want to do. And I decided, since I was doing something that I always wanted to do, I was going to follow the rules I always thought should be there.
I'm looking at it here. You're first down in Louisiana, and then sort of a quick back to New York and back in the car and down through the Smoky Mountains, right across Tennessee and Arkansas and into the mountains and plains. And you're really all over. You really did follow the crest.
Well, I did follow it. Spring begins really for. Especially for scientists, it begins at the beginning of February because they start thinking, as a friend of mine called it, salamander thoughts, thoughts of spring coming and the thaw coming and the first animals beginning to move. You have Groundhog Day comes in the beginning of February, which is, in a sense, an early celebration of spring. And in Louisiana, where I went, I went into western Louisiana, not to the Mardi Gras in New Orleans, but to the Mardi Gras in western Louisiana and these small towns where the celebration is very similar to the kinds of celebrations that the Italians and French celebrated in the Middle Ages. So there was a lot of both cultural and natural history to find out along the route. And so I had intended to see it all, and yet there was always so much that I realized I was missing. So there was this very strange sense that where should I go, where should I be? And so I kind of tried to stick to a schedule, but there was always something new to discover when I was going along the way.
It's January, it's still dark, you're getting ready, you're thinking about what spring is, what it means, and how it's changing. Could you dive in there, maybe page 14 or so, and give us something?
Sure. Spring, I know, is not a single sweep of warming, greening, migrating from south to north. Each place, each species, experiences its own spring, the valleys before the mountains, the south-facing slopes before those slopes that face north. Birds may depend on the changing hours of light to begin their migrations, but each bird has its own timing mechanism as well as its own navigation system. Insects hatch when the temperature allows. A cold, hard rain can keep migrating fish from moving upstream. Spring is the sum of all these individual responses to the changing light. Warming air, earth, and water, small changes can bring few or countless transformations. And each year is different. Even if we thought we might catalog every stimulus, account for every force, the fact is that nature has no obligation to respond to them in the same way. The unexpected is to be expected but can't be counted on. And who could count them? By the time of the vernal equinox, spring in the northern hemisphere is advancing north at a maddening pace. But something else is happening, too. Over the winter, as I collect items from newspapers, scientific journals, information from researchers I know, I find gathering evidence that spring has been changing, that across the northern hemisphere, spring is arriving earlier, as much as a week earlier, and in some places more than it did as little as 30 years ago. The reports come from every quarter and lend a growing sense of immediacy to my journey. Spring thaw comes sooner. In the mountains, snow melts earlier. Arctic sea ice is vanishing. Biologists as well as amateur watchers spot frogs, birds, bees, and butterflies arriving before their usual times. Insects that appear before the plants flower are left with no pollen on which to feed. If the insects disappear before the birds arrive, the birds, in need of energy for breeding and nesting after long flights, go hungry.
Bruce Stutz reading from Chasing Spring, and he did exactly that in his Chevy right across the country on the crest of the season. You can join our conversation, 800-423-8255. Lynn of Macadoches, Texas is with us. Hi, Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm not in Macadoches right now. I'm on my way going home. I'm on I-20. Near Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Great.
And I've been traveling from Charlotte. I left Charlotte yesterday, drove and tried to get through Atlanta last night, because who in the world wants to go through Atlanta in the daytime?
And can what do you see of spring on along the way, Lynn?
Well, it's interesting because when I left Charlotte, there was no wisteria in bloom, but I'm seeing wisteria in bloom down near Talladega now. I've been seeing it around Birmingham. And you're definitely, it's very interesting because the blooming Japanese cherries were in full bloom in Charlotte, and that's very early. That's, I would say, 2 weeks earlier than what you would normally expect there. And I remember my mother died in 1986, and they were, and that was in early April, and they were in bloom then. So that's probably 3 weeks earlier than what in 1986.
Lynn, we love your report from the highway headed south there towards Shreveport. Our phone line's a little rough, but we got the spirit. And the way we peg big events in our lives to what was blooming and what wasn't at the death of a loved one or along the highway. Bruce Stutz, you headed south yourself first, as you're saying, in Louisiana, a little further south than Lynn is yet, but she's headed there. You got there in time for the last crawfish harvest.
Got there in time for the last crawfish harvest, which is important there because they eat more crawfish in Louisiana the week of Mardi Gras than at any other time during the year.
I've been there for that. It's just wonderful. Those burlap bags full of crawfish coming up out of the what is it? It's the rice fields that they come out of.
They have they actually have rice paddies across the state, especially towards the northwest. And they switch crops, essentially. They have rice at certain times, and then they harvest the rice, and then they allow the crawfish to grow up in those fields. And the crawfish grow, and when they harvest the crawfish, then the ground is well-fertilized for the next crop of rice.
I remember that wonderful feeling as a kid heading south in the springtime. You know, we'd drive overnight, and it would be cold and snowy when I fell asleep in the car and wake up 500 or 800 miles later. and spring would be there. Diane's calling from Shelbsburg, Iowa. Hi, Diane. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
You were talking about what birds and what events mark it for you.
Yes.
Know?
What is it for you, Diane?
It was the bluebird I saw yesterday.
All right. How'd it look?
Such a beautiful, real color against the absolute brown of eastern Iowa this time of year.
Yeah.
So,
where did you see it exactly, Diane?
Oh, just on my way to work. Just I knew I'd see it because it's the same. Well, it's within a 2-day space that I've seen them in the last 4 or 5 years. I wish I had the record back to 20 years ago.
Well, this is what's been happening, Diane, is that a great number of people have been recording these things for a long time, and scientists
now. I think they have a scientific name for that.
Yeah, there's a word called phenology.
That's
which
it.
Is the
yeah.
study of the timing of natural events. And
right.
So scientists are actually beginning to look into the records that people themselves have kept to
see how... Oh, I keep them
how...
for like about 6 different birds, and the bluebird is like the absolute one, though.
That's wonderful, Diane. We love the picture of that bluebird. Bruce Stutz, you write about a family that had been keeping such records since, I forget, for centuries, has it been?
There was the founder of this scientist, of the founder of phenology. He began studying the timing of the plants blooming and the birds' arrival in his estate in England in the 18th century, and they continued that record all the way up to the end of the 19th century. So there is this very long record. A lot of the people in England took up the study of phenology, the timing of things, in part because it meant that if you could spend the time counting the blossoms on your estate, it meant you actually had an estate, which... Mm-hmm. Was an important part of things, but they
right.
eventually made it realize that it was a good way to account for the changes in nature.
And Bruce, you're on your winding way here up through the plains toward the Rocky Mountains. I mean, Diane saw a bluebird. You were there where the cranes dance and gather in enormous numbers. Describe that scene for us.
It's probably one of the key times of spring, and it's actually happening now. Actually begins in March, and it's the birds are migrating, these cranes are migrating north, and they stop over in Nebraska in order to feed and to begin their mating dances. And these mating dances consist of extraordinary leaps and raised wings and essentially dancing. And for centuries, for thousands of years, people have seen this all over the world because there's cranes all over the world. Mm. And the migration of the cranes signals spring. And a lot of the dances that celebrate spring and a lot of the ritual comes in some ways from watching these animals and watching their own dances.
I love the way you describe it. Cranes dance, chicks dance, adult mates dance, courting pairs dance, cranes dancing all over. But you also inform us that a sanctuary manager you talked to said that the birds there were in the worst physical shape that he had seen them in 30 years. Why?
Well, one of the big problems is again, in the West has been drought, and the water for these cranes and for the river, the Platte River that runs down, comes from the snowpack of the Rocky Mountains. And over the last 20, 30 years, that snowpack has been in decline. And so if there's less snow, it means there's less runoff, which means there's less water, and which means those areas dry up. And so the areas where the food is and where these cranes can actually sit and nest are becoming fewer and the food becoming diminished.
So some pressure on an amazing marker of spring there. Scott's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just calling to talk about a vernal pool that I stumbled into. I'm a photographer, and I go down to an area, southern Rhode Island's managed area.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what it was. I've heard of spring peepers. I know what they sound like, and I thought it might be turkeys. And I stood very quietly, and then I found that it was a vernal pool of wood frogs.
Wow! Yeah.
And I'd never seen a vernal pool alive before, but it was amazing. There's just seems like hundreds of these small wood frogs.
What month? What week? Do you remember, Scott? When exactly in the calendar?
It's right about now.
Yeah.
There was still ice on the edges of it, and there won't be ice this year because it's been a very warm, warm winter here. But it's right about now, so I was going to go down this weekend and see it again. I've been there twice, and it's just incredible.
Frogs gone wild.
Yeah, and skunk cabbage coming up, and it's just a very amazing time. And in a couple months, it's a completely different landscape.
I love that, and you bring to mind a terrific piece of writing from Bruce Stutz in his book. Bruce, I wonder if you'd set that up and maybe read for us. You've got some pretty sexy stuff going on in the vernal pool world for us. Where was that? And give us a read.
This was in just north of New York City. And for those who don't know, a vernal pool, vernal is another word for spring. And a vernal pool is a pool of water that appears in the springtime from snowmelt and rain and disappears by the end of spring and into the summer. And it's these pools in which salamanders and frogs, amphibians, do their mating. And as the listener said, the sound can be deafening of these frogs. They are very loud, and you kind of feel like you're either in the midst of a mosquito invasion or, as he said, turkeys, which is a nice sound for it. But let me read this section. On spring's first day, the forest's altitude is high enough that cold air still hangs in damp, vaporous virginal. Dead leaves lie a foot deep. Our boots break through some remaining patches of sun-glossed snow to softening mud beneath, where young vines already sprout blooded tendrils. Near the summit of the slope, we come upon a shallow swale filled with dark water, a vernal pool. Vernal, from the Latin ver, means of the spring. A vernal pool is a depression in the forest that fills in spring with snowmelt and rain. If you're going to think salamander thoughts, this is the place to do it. In the dark of early spring nights, when hard, cold rains fall, amphibians, frogs and salamanders, who must lay their eggs in water, arise from their winter burrows and as full of bearing and ardor as any dam-climbing salmon, rush by the thousands through the barely thawed woodlands, even beneath the snow, even across rain-swept roads, to reach these, their ancestral pools. Females meet males at the ponds, and salamander courtship ensues. The pairings begin with a male's tentative embrace, known scientifically and I think a little more sexily as amplexus, with the male, say, a shimmering black Jeffersonian salamander, pulling his way up the female's back until he can clutch her behind her forelimbs. Thus embraced, they may drift off for minutes or more, but soon the male begins to rub, first his snout along his mate's head, and then with flicks of his tail, his body back and forth, and presses his cloaca against her. In the throes of his ardor, with his tail lashing, he releases his grip and drifts up and apart from his mate. While he thrashes in his frenzy, she approaches and presses her snout between his lower limbs, which excites him into releasing packets of sperm. With swift movements, she picks them up as they fall and places them within her own cloaca in order to fertilize the 200 or more eggs she holds inside. A day or two later, she releases the eggs, small as shot pellets and bound up in protective, translucent, gelatinous clusters that cling to sticks and grasses in the pond. At the same time, the eggs of tiny fairy shrimp that dehydrated and frozen survived winter in the dried-up swale begin to hatch with the snowmelt and rain. The shrimp eggs will serve as food for the young salamanders, for by the time they're loose from their own egg mass, the parents will have retreated back into the forest. By late spring, the vernal pool, evanescent as a mirage, has dried up.
Bruce Stutz, reading from his book, Chasing Spring, and oh my goodness, a little amplexus ecstasy there. It really gets
it's
going down in the
season,
vernal pool.
It's a sexy season, Tom. It's a sexy season.
Yes, it is. Helen's calling from Parrishville, New York. Hi, Helen. You're on the air.
Hi, I love that story.
Me too.
The spotted salamander is the one we have here that does that. But the male builds a little turret out of gelatinous material and gets the female excited to bring her over to it.
Anyway. Come over and see my gelatinous material, baby. I love it. Do you see spring coming? And on what calendar, Helen?
Well, we're at the foothills of the Adirondacks. And so we still have ice on the river, except, of course, where the river is running. But in the places where it's dammed up a bit, we still have ice. And we're not safe to plant our gardens until May 30th. So what we do is
sounds
we get
late.
All these we have a fear of frost before
sure.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But for the last maybe 5 years, like the 15th would have been all right, but we don't dare take a chance. Our ground is not really warm enough, and so we plant everything inside because we can't stand it. Today it's 25 degrees, you know, but it's kind of a little bit sunny, and we can't stand the fact that we have to wait until May 30th.
You've got planting fever.
So we have the fever. We put everything in the house, and then it gets too leggy because we don't really have a lot of light, and we end up putting the seeds in the garden. So I go to the co-op, and I buy 2 packages of New Zealand spinach, and I put it in the house. Doesn't do well. Put it outside on May 30th, and it's fine.
But Ellen, we love the report. Thanks so much for that foot of the Adirondacks. It's great to hear your planting fever there. Carrie's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bruce. Great program. I just wanted to say that, yes, I think I'm hardwired. My fingers start to itch. I want to get in the dirt. And but I grew up and in Oregon, and the way I mark spring is that my father sends me a branch of Daphne in the mail, 3,000 miles, wrapped in wet, soaking paper and tissue.
Oh, I love it.
In a plastic bag, and I leave it on the counter, and for about a week, I stick my nose in it 3 times a day just to get that whiff of Daphne in that springtime memory.
And what's the scent of Daphne, Carrie? Can you describe it for us? Wrapped from Papa.
It's a beautiful bush. It's got different color pink blossoms, and it's quite sweet and fragrant. I would probably compare it to something tropical that you'd find in Hawaii.
And it puts you right back there in that Northwest spring. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Bruce Stutz, everybody's got their kind of spring trigger, the particular smell of earth or blossom or sighting that takes them to the moment.
Yeah, one of the great parts of spring is that all this energy that's coming from the sun and begins the snow melt and begins the ground softening and the flowers coming up is that all these natural events kind of present to us in the ways that we associate things with our senses. And so our sense of smell, as she said, she wants to get and touch the ground, the dirt. When for me, a lot of times with my family, we would go hunting for morel mushrooms in the spring, which is a wonderful smell. And to be out in the forest in the first spring, in the early spring, and to see these mushrooms coming up and to actually get down close to the ground and to smell the spring earth.
Unusual in that they come up in spring, not fall, and get you down right down there by the soil. Pete's calling from Ogdensburg, New York. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hi. What spring means to me is being able to get into the ground and dig up my horseradish plant and prepare it to eat with a good rare lamb roast for Easter.
So springtime, you can pull up that root. What, you grind it and make your own horseradish for the Easter lamb?
Yeah, that's right. It's a wonderful dish. You cut it with some mint jelly, and if it's fresh and if it's your own, all you do is you just dig it up and you add some clear vinegar and a pinch of salt, and it's a bit of heaven. It really takes the sting out of a cold spring.
Ah, we hear it. You can't get much more pungent than that.
One of the interesting things is that this kind of there's in the Smokies and in the Southern Mountains, they collect ramps in the spring.
Ramps.
And ramps are very garlicky onion, which is the kind of thing someone told me, you want to have ramps, you just don't come home that night after you have them. And this whole idea of these strong smells in the spring is in some ways eaten to get rid of the winter, the possible winter sicknesses that you might have had. And so, in fact, for instance, on the Passover dinner, having bitter herbs as part of the meal, because it's, again,
sure,
part of the celebration of spring.
Mm. Beautiful. Pete, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Jim is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. My name is Jim Winkler, and I'm listening to your show out on my morning walk. I wanted to make the point that we're in the middle of cherry blossom season here, a big deal in Washington, D.C. They seem to try and make cherries blossoms appear every year in timely fashion, but over and over and over again, the officials are disappointed. We have parades and festivals and so on, but they never quite align. And I think it's a good indicator that it's going to do what it wants when it wants.
We're not going to put a harness on exactly when spring comes. Jim, we love the picture of the cherry blossoms. And Bruce, you said right across the continent, even up into Alaska, it's coming earlier.
Yeah, well, in fact, in Washington, D.C., the Smithsonian did a study of cherry blossoms and found that they're now blooming a week earlier than they did. And these kind of events, the change events, not only made me kind of rush across the country. I got a desperate call from a scientist in the Rocky Mountains where I was going to go hiking with him to measure the snow pack in the Rockies. Mm-hmm. And he said, you better get here quick because the snow is almost gone. And so all these things are happening sooner, and they're happening all the way up into the Arctic. In Glacier National Park, the glaciers are pretty much vanishing and will be probably gone in 20 years. And even up into the Arctic tundra, you're having a spring come earlier, and you're having birds that didn't make it up to the Arctic make it up there, including robins, which the natives there have no word for.
You chased spring right up to its northern lip, right up into Alaska, flying over the Yukon and Porcupine Rivers. That's territory I know very well, and up onto the North Slope, which I know so well as well. And you wrote just wonderfully about it, the great caribou migration there in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I wish you'd give us a reading, Bruce. Here we are, basically at the end of your great journey, of what it felt like, what it meant to you to be watching that remarkable spectacle.
It's just extraordinary, and the timing is always important there because the caribou change and their migrations change. But I happened to get there when they got there. Beyond the braided channels that we're slogging through lies a low rise, a meadow of greening tundra. If we can reach the last hedgerow, we'll be behind a blind, barely 100 yards from the herd. We stay low and say nothing. We're close enough now that we're practically crawling through the dense thickets. When we're as far as we can go, we realize the only place to stand will be in mud and water. But we've come this far, and the view through the blind is like peering into a great cathedral through the crack between the doors. As it turns out, we're just in time to see the congregation filing in. From every low slope we see them coming, herds of hundreds joining the aggregation of thousands. They saunter in loose formation, large deer on gangly legs, many with fluff-tailed young, no more than a couple of weeks old, scampering alongside, some trying to grab a teat and suckle on the run. Once and again, an adult raises its head and pricks up its ears, seemingly aware of our presence, but then moves on, perhaps feeling safe among such numbers. Hunkered down below the willows, wet and cramped, we watch their march for hours. And for hours, under a vast blue sky, they continue to arrive, pass by our blind and move toward the sea, gradually becoming silhouettes on the distant flat plain, the place where the natives say life is born. Their spring journeys begin about the same time as mine. Here is where both our journeys end. The synchrony in this place, in this time of never-ending sun, fills me with inexpressible joy. My eyes burn from glare, wind, and tears.
Bruce Stutz, at the end of his great journey chasing spring there. Bruce, you started out in darkness, and there you're in the full sunlight of the Arctic with the caribou streaming in. And you, with that joy and tears, what about your personal journey on the crest of spring here? Did it shake you out of your dumps?
Well, it was a gradual process. For a while, I was so intrigued and trying to just see all of the spring that I could, that I wasn't conscious of whether I was actually changing or not. But towards the end of the journey, as the light was greater, as I moved north, and as spring was kind of reaching its end, I realized that I had been revived by the season. I had followed a trail that I wanted to travel, and I had accomplished a mission that I wanted to accomplish, and I had done it in a way that I didn't do it just perfunctorily. I actually was very, very attentive to all the things that were going on while it was happening, and that to me was was important, because no matter where you are, you don't have to go to the Arctic. You can see the changes in spring, as some of your listeners have said, everywhere. And to be attentive to them is to be attentive to the changes in life that go on around you.
But timelessness, you conclude, and we've just, I'm afraid, got half a minute. You say timelessness itself isn't what it used to be as you stared at spring. What do you mean by that?
Well, because of the changes, because of the climate change, we don't know what spring is going to hold for us later on. If spring is earlier and earlier, and the birds, which migrate based on the changes in light, which aren't going to change, but the insects that they feed on, the flowers that open up because of the warmth, if those get out of sync, then what happens is that then you begin to lose species that can't make the timing. And timing in nature is everything, as I found out in following spring. Mm.
See spring for yourself, Bruce Stutz concludes. See spring now, because it's changing. Bruce, it's a terrific journey that you take us on. We're very grateful to you for chasing it and for bringing us with you. Thank you so much for helping us into spring.
Thanks very much.
Bruce Stutz, his book is Chasing Spring, An American Journey Through a Changing Season. You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point.